You're listening to an iFanboy special edition podcast, Green Lantern Emerald Nights. Nights. It's like Havana Nights. Nothing but one big lull, then presto, you do a skull and find that you're reeling. She sighs and you're feeling like a toy on a string. And your heart goes ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding, ring-a-ding-ding. How could that funny face that seemed to be calm? Hey, everybody, I'm Paul Montgomery. This is iFanboy's special edition podcast for Green Lantern Emerald Nights, the latest direct-to-video release from DC Animation. Joining me is Mr. Chris Niesman.
Hello there.
And our resident scientist, I believe an expert in philately, Ryan Haupt.
That's true. It is the study of all things chartreuse.
Yes, and a rogue botanist as well. So you better bring the science on this conversation. We're talking about the latest direct-to-video release from DC Animation. This is Green Lantern Emerald Nights, and it is number of the direct-to-video releases. There's been a bunch of them, but this is an anthology movie in the same vein as Gotham Knights, one of the very earliest of these direct-to-video things. Different chapters produced by different art houses. And it's not necessarily a follow-up to Green Lantern First Flight, although some of the character designs look pretty similar. Yeah, this is, you know, whereas First Flight is an origin story for Green Lantern, and it actually shows, you know, Sinestro being his partner and then going sort of rogue. This one, Sinestro is, you know, he's on the side of good. There are glimpses of the Yellow Lantern Corps. And I guess I should say, spoiler alert, there will be some spoilers in this conversation. So what did we think of this one?
Much better than the first Green Lantern movie was my very first thoughts on it. And I'm a fan of the Tales of the Corps, you know, collections and those comics, and that's what this is. It's Tales of the Corps as an animated feature. So I loved it.
Ryan?
I think Alan Moore's going to be pissed.
Well, that goes without saying.
Well, yeah.
And no, but this was, I enjoyed this quite a bit as well. I really liked the structure. I thought it worked well, that the stories flowed into one another. It was cohesive, and the overarching plot device kind of kept it all together in a nice, neat little package.
Yeah, unlike Gotham Knights, which is it's an anthology movie, but Gotham Knights was sort of, it's set in sort of the Nolanverse. All of the Batman characters played by Kevin Conroy, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yep.
Kevin Conroy. Even when he looked sort of like that sort of fey kind of anime style, but
he looked like a little girl.
He did look a little weird, but
or 12-year-old boy.
And those were sort of disconnected. They all took place in sort of the same world, but there was no connective tissue really. With this one, there's, as Ryan said, there's an overarching story where Hal Jordan, played this time by Nathan Fillion. Yes, he finally has a superhero role.
Should we just pause and let everyone geek out for a second?
Well, he was in JLU as Vigilante, the cowboy character. Mm-hmm. But anyways, this is first big superhero role, and so if he finally gets his due. Nice in the role of Hal Jordan too. I think really good casting there.
He was wasn't he the voice of? Didn't he do Steve Trevor in the Wonder Woman?
Yes, he did. That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, he was very good there too. Yep. But yeah, so this is basically he's the narrator throughout, and he's telling stories to Aresia, a new recruit Lantern, and she's played by Peggy from Mad Men, Elizabeth Moss, mm-hmm. Also Zoe from West Wing.
Oh wow, I didn't even get that.
Yeah, there's a really great cast here. Well, so Sinestro is played by Jason Isaacs. Arnold Voss,
Henry Rollins, baby.
Henry Rollins is Kilowog. Arnold Vosloo as Abin Sur. He's the Arnold Vosloo is the mummy from all the mummy Brendan Fraser movies. Kelly Hu as Lyra, and let's see who else. Rowdy Roddy Piper as Bulfunga, the unrelenting.
I didn't know any of these other than Nathan Fillion, and it's kind of I don't know, there's good and pros and cons to not knowing the cast when you go into it, because you kind of get lost in the characters a little bit more, and then when you hear it later, you're like, oh, wow, it makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, the big question was, did Bulfunga come to chew gum and kick ass?
I think he did. I don't know if...
out of chewing gum?
I think he came to do that, and I don't think he was prepared for what he was going to meet at the turnbuckle.
That was a fun story.
That was a really fun story. And original story, was that illustrated by Dave Gibbons?
Yes.
Written in this movie by Dave Gibbons, but he was the original illustrator of the story, right?
And it was written by a young Mr. Alan Moore.
That's right. So very cool story. It's the Mogo story. And I read some reviews about this movie where people were complaining that, even if they weren't familiar with the original story, if they were watching it, they felt that it was telegraphed, that it was clear that Bulfunga, the unrelenting, this crazy warlord who was going after this very antisocial lantern to try and kill him, it was very clear that this lantern Mogo was actually the planet he was on. And even knowing that, that did not hurt this sequence whatsoever.
No, it's kind of the inside joke that everybody in the room, except for the one guy, knows
exactly
that, what the joke is. So it didn't hurt it. I mean, we all know that Mogo's a planet, and I enjoyed it.
Mm.
So what's interesting about that story in particular is the framing device for the original comic. I've actually got it open in front of me. I grabbed the book before we started recording. It's almost exactly what the framing of device for the overall movie was, in that the story in the comic is Orisa going through the Book of Oa and finding all these old stories, and Tomar Ray, filling the role of Hal Jordan from the movie, tells her about, there's Mogo, and he doesn't like to... literally the line is, Mogo doesn't socialize.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells the story of Bulfunga, the Unrelenting, and it's almost the exact same story. And then it even ends with the same joke about, like, maybe one day I'll tell you about the really big lanterns.
And that's cool. As a comic fan, I love that. I love that they're being not so literal, to the detriment of these stories, but they're mining comics and comics history to make it not just entertaining for us, but they're fun, entertaining stories. There's no problem doing that and putting those in there. I don't know, man on the street that is interested in the upcoming Green Lantern movie, how much they're going to like this. But as a comic book fan, this is one of my favorites because, like I said at the beginning, it really felt like I was watching a collection of Tales of the Core.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I mentioned in the written review on ifanboy.com is that I think, I agree with you that this is great for comic fans, and there's a lot of lore that you're like, I never would have thought that I'd see, Mogo in a movie, on Blu-ray in my home theater. It's just crazy. Even to see, characters like Abin Sur and stuff. So it's all very surreal. But I think this is even going to be exciting for, modern kids who are really into the Star Wars Clone Wars stuff right now.
Oh, yeah.
The first story in this is the first Lantern story, and this shows how the very first, there was the first group of Green Lanterns, but they don't consider them the first Lanterns. The first Lantern is the one who first made a construct with his ring, and it's a bunch of sort of nobody Lanterns, really weird-looking alien characters, like, background characters from the Mos Eisley Cantina, basically, going on this mission against this invasion force, and it's this huge, like, space battle with the Green Lanterns out floating in space, picking apart these ships with rays from their ring, not yet using constructs. And then we finally get to the point where one of these Lanterns, a former scribe, makes a sword out of, like, a big green broadsword out of his lantern energies and cuts through a ship, and then the other guys figure out what's going on. They start making constructs, and they sort of lay waste to this invasion force of hostile aliens. And really visually spectacular. I think a step above what we normally see in the, you know, the Timverse animation. As much as I love that stuff, but
big, awesome space battles.
Yeah, I mean, they're really playing up the, you know, the anime visual style, the dynamism and stuff. And there's some really exciting fights in here. I would say that one really sets the tone. That first story. Then we get some sort of more melee combat with the Lyra story, where it's like these exotic alien cultures and sort of like a samurai story, basically.
Absolutely.
Very Shakespearean. There's some ritual suicide in there. And that one's written by Eddie Berganza. We should mention that like all these stories are written by some people that you probably recognize. There's a Peter Tomasi story in there with Kilowog. There is Mark Guggenheim.
Co-credited with my my boy Chris Somney on that one.
Is he really?
Yeah, yeah. Chris, if you look in the credits, it was I believe that was the Pete Tomasi and Chris Somney.
Oh, that's right, and that's because it was based on a story from the Tales of the Core from the
Blackest Night.
Right. Okay, yeah. That's very cool. Yeah, and then you know we've got Dave Gibbons, as we said, Alan Burnett.
Mark Guggenheim,
and we should mention that the different sequences are it's three different directors: Chris Berkeley, Lauren Montgomery, no relation, and Jay Oliva, and all doing a really bang up job. The thing about it is there's a wide diversity of stories, but it feels there's a consistency throughout, unlike what we saw in Gotham Knight.
Yeah,
everything feels like it belongs in the same universe.
Basically. Yeah, it was one big story that, you know, like Ryan said, the framing device is this much larger story, and so you get these nice vignettes, which makes sense because Hal is kind of bringing along the rookie and making her feel a little bit more at ease in her surroundings, which, you know, plays, you know, a bigger role later. One of the things, talking about the very first story, the first Lantern that was nerding out about was I forget the character's name, but it was the first Lantern, the Scribe.
And the
surprise on the part of not just the thousands of warriors that had assembled there hoping to be picked as a Lantern, but also the Guardians had no idea the kind of consciousness of the rings and the Green Lantern force that it would seek out this Scribe. I assume because of his imagination and will, and which I thought was great. And then it kind of builds the Green Lantern mythos, because we find out that these rings, as the Green Lanterns die, the rings shoot off and find new recruits. And that ring is the one that would eventually go to Abin Sur and then Hal Jordan. Which I thought was really cool.
It's sort of like when you go into like deep into Tolkien with like the Silmarillion or whatever, you trace the path of the rings and, you know, the prehistory and stuff. And, you know, this apparently you're listening. There's also, I should mention, there's a Geoff Johns and Dan DiDio commentary on this movie. And they talk about, you know, this first Lantern story. And I believe this is a new character. They said they haven't, you know, hasn't been used in the comics before. This is like billions of years in the past, and just looking at the scope of the Green Lantern mythology, it's really cool. There are things I liked about First Flight. I think they got a lot of things done pretty well, but here it's just, even if it's not Hal's story, which some people might want, this is really the core story.
Yes.
And it just shows, it's sort of like getting like a Jedi anthology, you know, the adventures of the Jedi or something, and seeing all these different kinds of lanterns.
Yeah, First Flight was the story of, you know, we are Hal Jordan in that story. It's like, what if one of us were all of a sudden recruited into this really mysterious, bizarre galactic space corps, where, you know, the Tales of the Core and this movie, it's like, no, they throw you into the world, and this is what it is. You know, one of my favorite comics growing up was Alien Legion, and because I love that idea of a cosmic French Foreign Legion, and that's I always loved that book, and that's what the Green Lantern Corps, you know, at its best for me is, it's kind of like the French Foreign Legion in a faraway galaxy, And this really kind of embraces that, which I, you know, I love that about it.
It's a section of the DC universe that really lends itself to the anthology treatment.
Right.
What did you guys think of Nathan Fillion as Hal, even if he did take sort of a, you know, background role in this, playing the narrator and, playing instead of being the up and comer rookie guy, he was this is a wise Hal. This is a more mature Hal Jordan.
No, he didn't really do a whole lot. He kind of just was there and knew some stories and was generally rather charming, but he's not really the crux of any of the particular narratives, even the overarching ones. So
he did what Nathan Fillion does so well. He was a calm, relaxed, charming, you know, guy, and that's what that character was supposed to do in that story. He was supposed to get Arisia to kind of relax and say, hey, this isn't, you can do this. And
yeah, that was good.
He has that kind of warm, reassuring personality. So yeah, he was great.
Really quick though, before we go too far into the nitty gritty, going back to what you were talking about just a second ago and how Green Lantern has a really nice template for doing these kind of stories. I think one of the main complaints about people dropping the book lately has been, I just want them to be space cops, and I'm tired of the grandiose, you know, emotional spectrum and prophecy and all that stuff. If you're looking for more of a, let's watch them be space cops and do cool things, this is exactly it.
Yep.
I agree with that.
There is prophecy and there is like big important things happening, but it definitely has more of the, these are Green Lanterns being Green Lanterns and this is their day in, day out job.
It's streamlined without it feeling limited. Because, you know, by and large, Green Lanterns, you know, in and of themselves, without the other kind of lanterns, the different multicolored, you know, lanterns, it's really rich. And so I do agree that when you go into having, you know, as much as I sort of like the Blue Lantern sometimes and the Red Lanterns, and we do see Atrocitus here, although he's not technically a Red Lantern yet, and we do see that glimpse of Sinestro as a Yellow Lantern. And the prophecy. And that's kind of a cool tease. I think this like goes as far as you want it to, sort of.
Tom Cater said something going back a few years that has always stuck with me. And he said, I like my cosmic with a little C, not a big C.
Yeah.
And what he meant from that is that exactly what Ryan was saying is that, you know, you can get into these cosmic outer space stories and focus on the philosophy and the, you know, the universe as a whole and into this almost like pseudo religion about it, or you can have cowboys in outer space. And I think we all, you know, that's why I think a lot of people love the first three Star Wars movies, is that was cosmic with a small C. And whenever they started, you know, with the midi-chlorians and all that, that started to become the big C. And it's like, that stuff isn't interesting. I want to see cowboys and Indians in space.
Midi-chlorians are for my pool, nowhere else. They're not for my Star Wars. No, but I agree with that. And I think that one of the things that it's sort of the beauty of when these direct-to-video animated films work, the, you know, going with this sort of the 70-minute structure that limits them sometimes. And sometimes it's a very good thing because
Sure. They
can't go totally balls to the wall and they have to streamline and simplify. And that's why, say, like Batman the Red Hood, which or Under the Red Hood, which I think is one of the strongest of these so far. That one's such a pleasant surprise because it perfects, you know, the original comics arc. Like, and it gave Winnick a chance to take what flaws he found in the comic afterwards in retrospect and say, listen, this is how I can really make this story a lot simpler and a lot more effective. And that's what they did with the film. Sometimes it's to the detriment of these movies that they're so short and they can't, you know, go as crazy as you can with several dozen issues of a comic book. But I think here it's really to the benefit that they said, okay, we can do some really big stories, but we can only do these, you know, handful.
I didn't feel cheated at all. I didn't feel like, oh wow, I wish that they had really expounded on Mogo and who Mogo is. Yeah. You know, it's like, no, he's a big fucking planet
the
with
the perfect amount of Mogo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I didn't feel like this one was short at all. Some of the movies I felt this could have been longer. Some of the movies I've actually felt this could have been shorter, and I found myself looking at my watch, even 70 minutes long. But this one, I mean, you know, because it was varied, you know, like we haven't even mentioned the Kilowog kind of Poozer origin story. We haven't mentioned we mentioned, I guess, briefly the Abensur and Atrocitus story, which again, that was a direct adaptation from an Alan Moore story. So yeah, I mean, there's just, there was a lot of little things going on, and even just talking about it with you guys, I'm ready to sit down and watch it again.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's always a good thing. My one nitpick is those are, you wanted me to do the science. Those are some noisy space battles, Paul.
For the vacuum of space. They are very noisy. I did notice that in the first Lantern story. It's kind of hard to hear the dialogue sometimes. Because the space battles are so, like, it's like these concussive blasts, and it's very loud and space opera-y. And,
yes. And now, if I was writing my column on iFanboy, I mean, I would just say that the ring interprets what the viewer sees and gives them sound to help them fight better.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's kind of a cop-out.
Right. They can't hear fanboys whine in space.
That's good. I wish, I'd like to join them.
You're spoiled on the Joss Whedon thing of you know, Firefly having no volume for the ships moving, you know, when they're
overseas. I'm not a huge Firefly Joss Whedon fan. Okay. I guess I'd forgotten that that was even part of it. I remember it from Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
And from that opening scene in the new J.J. Abrams Star Trek, which was pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But also, that's a really small sun, if that's the scale of things that was going on.
We didn't even mention Krona. Yeah, the you know, so what's one of the cool things about it is having that overarching narrative of Hal Jordan and sometimes Sinestro telling stories to Arisia. It's not just story time. It's all progressing towards a big conflict in outer space involving a Galactus-sized Krona, basically, and it being a very big fight. And so that was kind of cool.
Well, kind of what it reminded me of, it was a big troop deployment. So you had the young troops and then the old veteran troops, and they're evacuating Oa. So you have kind of the old timers are killing time by telling stories to the rookies.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it was just, you know, these times in between these big troop deployments as they're moving around preparing for this battle. So yeah, that's what they do, is tell stories.
It's just, I think it was just a very thoughtful structure for doing this kind of movie. So
yeah, I like it.
And then my one last, like, really awesome comment is I noticed that Sinestro, I thought to myself, like, I wonder if Sinestro is left-handed. Like, that would make sense, because, like, Sinestro, Sinister. And I noticed that when he uses his Green Lantern ring, he's actually right-handed. So I was disappointed. I was kind of like, oh, man, that would have been such a nice little touch. He's left-handed when he has the yellow ring on.
Ah.
That's interesting.
So the fear, the sinisterness, it comes through more with the yellow, and he moves it over the left hand.
All right, left-handed people, don't send us any emails, please.
I'm left-handed. That's why I was excited.
All right. Okay, so let's talk about the next thing up on the docket for DC Animation. This one, we've been excited about, hearing rumors about it for months and months. Batman Year One, the, like, definitive Batman story for, you know, by Frank Miller and Mazzucchelli. And we got to see a little bit of a sneak preview on the DVD. And not a lot of the animation, but we did see some character designs. And they did talk a lot about how directly they're going to be adapting this movie. And the big thing, you know, Chris doesn't know the casting yet, but we do. Okay.
Tell me.
All right. So for young Bruce Wayne, you know, like in his 20s, it's going to be Ben McKenzie from The O.C. And was it Southland? And okay, so there's Bruce Wayne. That's not the exciting news. Okay,
Good.
Jim Gordon is Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad, Malcolm in the Middle.
Oh, nice!
And he's awesome. And he sounds great.
Very cool.
Really so good. Let's see who else. Katie Sackhoff is going to play his
wife.
Not his love interest. No.
Is it
the other woman?
Other woman.
The other detective.
They're keeping that storyline in.
Yes.
Wow.
Which is one of the things that's sort of been impressing a lot of people, is that they are keeping, like, you know, a lot of, you know, any drug use and any infidelity and stuff. And this is so.
But Catwoman is still a prostitute.
Is still a prostitute, and it's Eliza Dushku is playing Catwoman. And as she says in the thing, she is reaching down into the depths of Eliza Dushku to find her one of her bad girls to play this Catwoman. And they all pretty much, they all sound pretty good. The only thing, Ben McKenzie, when he's playing Batman, he's doing sort of the Christian Bale thing where he's getting very gruff and it sounds a little
very raspy,
unintentionally funny. But otherwise, I think it's a lot of smart choices. They stress that this is like the most direct adaptation they've ever done. They're pretty much using the comic as a storyboard. Not to enrage Gabriel Hartman by the comparison.
I was gonna say I hate it when people say that, but I mean
Gabe's no, but they're like that. Basically they're going frame by frame sort of, and
they're doing a very literal interpretation of it.
Lifting a lot of dialogue from it. They're even playing with the coloring that Mezzakelli used, and we didn't see any moving animation, but we did see some character designs, and it, you know, looks pretty damn close to Batman Year One. So
nice.
So very excited about that one. And I do suppose that's it for this discussion of Green Lantern Emerald Knights. Thanks for joining us. Remember to check out my full written review on ifanboy.com, and also the great content from Brian and Chris. Lots of science writing, and of course the Don't Miss podcast from week to week. So we'll see you next time. My name is Paul Montgomery.
I'm Christopher Neithman.
And I'm Ryan Haupt.
See you next time.
Bell goes ring-a-ding-ding, 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 ring-a-ding-ding.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is a, like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong, maybe it's a moment, it's an injustice, is something that just you keep going on and on over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it. You know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.